Welcome to Lessons in Leadership, Steve Adubato with my co-anchor, our executive producer, Mary Gamba. Mary, we're going to be talking in just a minute to our good friend, Phil Olaje, who is the chief of staff in Essex County for the county executive, Joe DiVincenzo, and also a Democratic strategist who has been a key advisor to incoming Democratic governors. We're talking about transitions from an election, Mary, where political leadership matters, to governmental leadership. That's a huge shift.
It is a huge shift. And I believe, and again, I've never done this, and you can talk a little bit more to it, but I believe that that transition, when you're campaigning, when you're making promises, when you're going out there and you want to be perceived in a certain light, it must really totally evolve when you're actually in that role. Now you need to do, you need to perform, you need to be seen. What was your experience with that?
Well, listen, as a legislator, I was in the mid-80s as a young, very young person elected to the legislature. Legislative transitions are not the same as executive transitions.
Sure.
Legislative transitions are easier, in my opinion, because you're not responsible for getting stuff done. So I'll give you an example. We're in New Jersey, but over in New York, Mayor Mamdani, as a candidate, he was a very strong candidate. He won by a lot. All of a sudden, he's elected, and now there's snow and garbage all over the streets. And being a democratic socialist, it's not political at all. That doesn't pick up the garbage or clean up the snow. Transition. Transition means politics and rhetoric and speech making do not get stuff done.
Agreed.
That's what Governor Sherrill's dealing with in New Jersey. That's what Phil understands because he did it with the county executive, Joe DiVincenzo, a couple of decades ago. And so that's the conversation. I'm fascinated by this, Mary, aren't you?
I sure am. I'm looking forward to a great conversation. It's always great when you and Phil are together.
Mary and I will be back right after this. Phil Olaje. We are honored to be joined by Phil Olaje, who is the chief of staff in Essex County for the county executive, Joe DiVincenzo, and also a Democratic strategist who has seen just a few transitions from campaign leadership to governmental leadership. Good to see you, Phil.
Good to see you, Steve. Excited to talk about this. Exciting times in New Jersey.
You've done it a few times, the transition, the transitional leadership, right?
Absolutely. Coordinated with the executive director for Joe's transition and been involved in a few. But they say, I love this quote I read. A campaign is like poetry, big ideas, motivation, inspiration. A government is like prose, punctuation. You got to just make sure the sentences make sense. So it's totally different, campaigning and governing.
I was just talking about the mayor over in New York, Mamdani, who running was one thing, and then he gets elected. And Mikey Sherrill, they get elected at the same time, governor of New Jersey. And all of a sudden, you've got a snowstorm. We're doing this in mid-January. It'll be seen later. Hopefully, the weather will be a lot nicer. Phil, how the heck do you prepare for that kind of leadership when you have a crisis, a weather crisis, right off the bat?
I think you just have to be hands-on. I mean, you know, during the campaign, you pick the issues. You talk about what you think makes you look good. But when you govern, the issues pick you, right? You didn't decide that that snowstorm was going to hit a week after you got inaugurated. So you need to make sure you're visible, you're present. You don't decide, hey, I just got sworn in, I'm going to take that trip to Aruba or Cancun and relax. You have to be present. They both were out. They were on television. They were talking. And they made mistakes. But I think, you know, as long as you're on top of your staff, and you have to make sure you have great staff and you're hiring people. You know, this first 100 days for any administration is very difficult. You need to find the right people that can do the job, you know.
Hey, Phil, I remember you told me offline, we were having a conversation the other day about this. And you said, because I said, come on, you got to be prepared. You got to think of all the possibilities. And you go, And you told me about two situations. Do them real quick. Do the train story.
Number one is they were reporting to us exactly what we're in charge of in our fleet.
In Essex County, about a million people, a few less, but go ahead.
Talking to me about the fleet, you know, we have 700 and some cars. We have so many trucks. We have so many ambulances or emergency vehicles. We have this and we have two trains. And I'm like, we have two trains? What are you talking? Were you looking in the right? We're not New Jersey Transit. We're not Amtrak. And they're like, yes, Turtleback Zoo has two trains, and what they break down, they need oil, they need to be fixed. We have to do that. In my 20s, I mean, I never even thought about that. That was something as chief of staff that we'd have to deal with in the county. And I'm sure the new administrations are dealing with that right now.
So you find out things that you aren't That you really don't know. By the way, Turtleback Zoo is run by, and go visit Turtleback Zoo. It's incredible. And Phil and the county executive, Joe DiVincenzo, who we'll have on again soon, they've done a great job at improving Turtleback Zoo. Along those lines, Phil, I'm curious about this. I don't like saying this because, by the way, to disclose, Phil and I are longtime friends. We grew up in the same neighborhood together. Phil, I don't like saying this, but you're a strong leader in your own right. You've led a lot of initiatives within the county and on the state level as well. But being a chief of staff is not being the chief executive. What is leadership like for a chief of staff versus the chief executive? A and B, how important is that you're on the same page and have the trust to have hard conversations? Loaded question, I know.
I think it's vitally important that the chief of staff and the executive, if it's governor, mayor, or county executive in my case, are on the same page on a lot of stuff. The executive has to have the trust that the chief of staff can make decisions that he or she agrees with, right? I mean, I'm very comfortable. Joe and I have had a long relationship. You know, we think alike. I know what he's thinking. But I also have to be in a position where if I think he's making a mistake, I have to be able to go in there and say, Joe, no, I disagree. This is why. And if the executive respects the chief of staff, he'll have to assess it. Sometimes Joe says, no, I disagree with you. And ultimately, the difference is the chief executive makes the decision, right? I'm trying to give him all the information, and ultimately, he decides whether we go left or right here.
And what happens in an administration at any level, the federal level, the state level, the county level, local level? What happens if the chief executive has a quote leadership style where he or she, they're not particularly interested in your feedback or your opinion, but they are interested in your praise, constant and never ending?
Well, I think that if you had strong people, if you hire strong, smart, intelligent employees and chiefs of staff, you won't have them for a long time. Because if they feel undervalued and they're not contributing, why would they want to be part of it? You know, one of the great things in New Jersey is like, I think Mikey Sherrills is going to come into this, not like a typical political person. She's going to come into this as a Navy commander. She's going to come in taking the bridge, assessing the situation, getting her team together. And doing a good job. And then that's what makes a great leader. Ultimately listening, but making the tough decisions.
It's interesting you're talking about Governor Sherrill. She does have the military background, a decade, if not more, in the military. To what degree do you actually believe that military leadership background helps prepare her to be the chief executive of the state?
I think she's been trained to make decisions, to get input, to change on the fly if there's an emergency. You know, she's had to deal with all that. I just think it's different, and I think that's what we need right now. I mean, even New York with the mayor, different, right? We'll see if his background, his training, and that difference is effective. But, you know, I think we're looking forward to someone who's Annapolis trained, Naval Academy trained, coming in and doing what they need to do, not a typical politician.
Yeah, let me follow up on that. So, viewers of Lessons in Leadership know that I'm obsessed by the concept of owning your mistakes, taking responsibility. I wrote in one of my earlier books, my original Lessons in Leadership, I wrote a chapter on the great late General Colin Powell, who acknowledged that his testimony before the United Nations about weapons of mass destruction was wrong. And there were some who said, why would you ever admit that publicly? And he said, because I was wrong. And that's what leaders do. They acknowledge their mistakes. One of my favorite books, Extreme Ownership, the graphic will come up, written by two Navy SEALs who talk about the fact that they have to own everything in the universe, including, Phil, the mistakes. Joe DiVincenzo, who both Phil and I have known for years because, by way of background, Phil, you started working with Joe as a kid in recreation programming in Newark at the North Ward Center that my dad founded. Full disclosure, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I think that's why we're so cohesive. I've been with Joe since I'm 15 years old.
What
It's
was
a
Joe's favorite expression about team? There's no what.
there's no I in team. It's two
Joe
in DiVincenzo
always
about.
say that again.
There's two in DiVincenzo, which makes me a little nervous.
And by the way, Joe was a great high school and college quarterback who also played some pro ball as well. He's a great quarterback. And for those of us in the neighborhood, Joe would often use sports analogies to talk about leadership. And there's a reason I'm going there. There are some who believe in leadership positions in a transition like this or whatever. that you don't acknowledge your mistakes publicly. I'm not a fan of that view, and I believe that true great leadership is acknowledging your mistakes, owning them, and saying what you've learned from them and what you'll do moving forward. You say what?
Absolutely. I also think when you make a mistake and you bring your team together, you talk about it. I think that's the only way you can fix a mistake is if you recognize it. Let's self-scout. Let's look at what we did. Why did we get to that decision? Let's realize it was a mistake and make sure it never happens again. So I think it's important to have a great team around you. You know where why things that went great, and why when things go bad, why they went bad. I think you have to look at that too. It's not just a matter of admitting the mistake. It's trying to figure out, hey, why did we decide to go left? Why were we so adamant that going left was the right decision and it turned out to be a disaster? So if you can think about that decision-making process and why you got to the wrong decision, then you may never make it again.
Before I let you go, Phil, real quick, I'll give you a chance to plug this. You've been involved in girls' women's softball for a few years?
Absolutely. I think we're on almost our 40th year, believe it or not. And, you know, they say the most successful people are people who play college athletics, particularly among female athletes. If you look, the percentage of successful women in business, the majority of them have played college athletics. I just think there's something about teamwork, you know, military, all that stuff about building great leaders.
And Phil, the softball organization you're connected to is?
New Jersey Pride Softball, the East Coast Elite Program.
Good. We just put the plug up. Hey, Phil, thank you, my friend. The leadership journey never ends. We'll talk soon.
Looking forward to it.
You got it. Steve Adubato, Phil Elagi, talking leadership, particularly with a new governor in New Jersey facing a whole range of challenges representing all of us, 9 million people in the state. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This edition of Lessons in Leadership is made possible by the Buccino Leadership Institute at Seton Hall University, Prager Metis, Valley Bank, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 825, NJ Transit, the Northport Center, O'Toole Scrivo, Gingoli Construction, New Jersey Sharing Network, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, The Helix, Fedway Associates, Inc., the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, Choose New Jersey, and Seton Hall University, inspiring great minds to greater purpose since 1856.
This is Mary Gamba. If you want more leadership tips and tools, log on to stand-deliver.com. That's stand-deliver.com.
Promotional support for this edition of Lessons in Leadership with me, Steve Adubato, and my colleague, Mary Gamba, has been provided by NJ.com, NJBIA, and New Jersey Business Magazine, CIANJ, and Commerce Magazine, and the Meadowlands Chamber and Meadowlands Media. Mary and I are thrilled to be joined by our good friend Barbara Mintz, Senior Vice President, Social Impact and Community Investment, RWJ Barnabas Health, one of our longtime partners and underwriters. Barbara, tell everyone your background in nutrition, what it is.
Yes, I'm a registered dietitian. I've been doing this work now for 20, 25 years. Started out at Newark Beth Israel Medical Center as a nutrition counselor, and then kind of worked my way through some of what we're seeing today, which is the social determinants of health, specifically food insecurity.
Let's talk about food insecurity. How serious is the issue, and what is RWJ Barnabas Health doing to address it?
Well, it certainly is one of the social determinants of health that is most closely linked to our health outcomes. I mean, many of the diseases that we're seeing in our emergency rooms and in our primary care offices are linked to food intake. Diabetes, heart disease, obesity, all of those things are related to what we choose as food. However, if we don't have access to healthy food, we're not going to be able to really address those things in our own health and wellness. So what we do as a system is try to look at food insecurity and nutrition insecurity at the same time. I guess most people just look at it as a lack of food, but it really is not just a lack of food. It is a lack of healthy food. So with that, you have to be able to provide access to this healthy food. So as a system, we address the issue at its root cause, which is making sure that we do have access through developing models, business models, and distribution models for food, healthy food, vis-a-vis farmers, et cetera, to get into the places that it's needed the most. Because food insecurity really is not just, It's not the lack of food per se, especially in the Garden State here. It is the lack of the ability to get it to the places where it needs to be the most.
Absolutely. Mary, jump in.
Barbara, you talked about the farmers and you talked about a whole network, a cohort of people that come together. That raises a question that you and I had talked offline a little bit about, which is harvest. And the little bit that I know about it is super inspiring. It's a collaboration. It's bringing together people. It's partnership. Steve and I talk on Lessons in Leadership all the time about the importance of partnerships and bringing people together. Can you tell us what harvest is and the partnership that you are helping to collaborate with them?
Well, harvest is a kind of a way to pull all of this together. It provides not only a place to aggregate and distribute this food, because we are in partnership with farmers, over 30 of them throughout the state of New Jersey, but it's also a place to incubate businesses, food businesses, if you will. It's right on Halsey Street in Newark, and we will be able to connect with local restaurateurs and entrepreneurs and culinary artists in those spaces to bring their expertise into the city of Newark, as well as develop a business model for this particular situation. So we also have a teaching kitchen, which will allow us to bring a registered dietitian to come in and teach the reasons why we should be choosing healthy food and how to cook it, so to speak. It really does, to me, as someone who has been doing this work for a while, bring together the three critical partners that you mentioned, Mary. One of them is agriculture, healthcare, and education. Without those three together in this perfect trine, we're never going to be able to move the needle in this space. So this gives us an opportunity, and not that big of a space, about 8,500 square feet, to really pilot this effort, if you will. Get our farmers connected to a good business model, get our folks connected to the proper nutrition education, as well as help the local businessman.
I'm going to follow up on this. The SNAP Navigator program, what is it and why is it so important, Barbara?
Well, it's a program that we started with the Department of Family Development last year. I think we're the only healthcare system in the country to do something like this and take this on. But we've hired 12 SNAP navigators and two managers of these navigators to actually embed themselves in the communities within our catchment areas in all of our 12 acute care hospitals. So this model's different because they're not only connected with our community health worker program, which is an inpatient model, if you will. Those folks are embedded in our emergency rooms, so they could get to connect with those who screen food insecure. But these folks are deployed to community partners. They're in churches, they're in schools, local bodegas, supermarkets, et cetera, just to make sure our community members, whether they're our patients or not, are connected with this important benefit. SNAP is really also an economic driver.
They used to be called, I'm sorry, Barbara, it used to be called food stamps, right?
Yes, they did. Now it's nutrition, it's supplemental nutrition assistance program. That's what it's called.
Right. And connecting people, I'm sorry for interrupting, Barbara, but connecting people, good. That's so hard because people are like, where do I go? Mm-hmm. And you're helping them do that. Talk about that more.
Yeah, so I think since RWJ Barnabas Health is a trusted source for many things in health, having us in there as a navigator helps connect them to the social services, not just the clinical services. So it really does, they know to come to us. They're in all of our community partners within our local community. So it's a corporate-driven initiative, but it's locally implemented. I mean, very hyperly locally implemented. So we work with our community health leaders in each one of the facilities to make sure that they are reaching out to folks who, and letting them know that we are here and we can get them an application and get them on their way to receiving SNAP.
Navigating the governmental process to get the services one needs, easier said than done. Go ahead, Mary.
Barbara, you talked about access and you talked about education, and those two in my mind, because the access of the fast food, of the every day you turn on the TV, there's a new $5 meal, there's a new $3 meal. I'm like, how do you get all this food for only $5? How are you moving that needle that you talked about earlier when it comes to helping individuals to understand the difference between fast food, right, a $5, $6 biggie bag, whatever they are, and having access to that healthier food? How do you help to change that dialogue? Because I know for me, it tastes really good.
Yeah, unfortunately, it does. It's almost predatory in nature. If you look at some of the underserved areas...
Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's
so
cheap.
Good.
And it's like if a mom is really struggling, she's working a job and two jobs and has all of these kids and she needs to feed them, she can go right through a drive-through and get all of this unhealthy food at a very affordable price. So we try to help folks navigate that environment, if you will. We have many curriculums. One of them is our Kids Fit program that teaches kids and their families how to make better choices within this environment, and also how to shop with their SNAP. So if they go into a supermarket and they pick the right ingredients for a healthier meal, it could also be affordable to them. Also understanding that sometimes time is a huge issue, and it's not easy to prepare meals for kids if you're working. And even if we weren't living in an underserved area, it would be a difficult thing to do. So to really drive that home at an early age with family members does help them to understand that there is a connection between how they feel, how they perform in the classroom or on the playing field or at work with the food that they're eating.
Before I let you go, Barbara, what is a food pharmacy?
A food pharmacy is not your typical food pantry. It is a clinically integrated model that actually provides not only healthy food access to those who screen food insecure, but also consultations with a registered dietitian. They get referred by their primary care or their specialty doctor. They can go meet with a dietitian and get access to healthy food in a very dignified, supportive manner, where they will be shopping with a dietitian to get their food, healthy produce from our farmers that I mentioned before, and in a partnership with the Community Food Bank of New Jersey twice a month. So it makes sure that they are still connected to their clinical care that they need and also get the food and the education that they need to stay healthy and well or manage their chronic conditions.
Sorry, Barbara. Barbara mentions the Community Food Bank of New Jersey, one of our longtime partners creating greater public awareness around food insecurity. The RWJ Barnabas Health website will be up. This has been up the entire segment. Go on that site. Find out more. Navigate it. Barbara's used the word navigate. Navigate through the system to find out different initiatives and programs at RWJ Barnabas Health. Barbara, we thank you and the team at RWJ Barnabas Health for being important partners in the community and making a difference every day. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for your support.
You got it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Mary Gamba. If you want more leadership tips and tools, log on to stand-deliver.com. That's stand-deliver.com.
Promotional support for this edition of Lessons in Leadership with me, Steve Adubato, and my colleague, Mary Gamba, has been provided by NJ.com, NJBIA, and New Jersey Business Magazine, CIANJ, and Commerce Magazine, and the Meadowlands Chamber and Meadowlands Media. Welcome back to Lessons in Leadership, Steve Adubato. I'm going to do something that we don't normally do here. And it's me alone offering some perspective and then joined by my two colleagues, Elvin Badger, Frank Brown, our two tremendous behind-the-scenes leaders. So here's what I've been thinking. So I'll tell you what I'm not here to talk about. I'm not here to talk about immigration policy or ICE by themselves, but I am talking about this. As a leadership coach, Lessons in Leadership tries to help understand how leadership works or doesn't work, the mistakes we make, how we learn from those things. Here's my concern. Now, I've talked to several law enforcement professionals in the last several weeks, none of whom were willing to come on the air. These are top-level law enforcement leaders. None of whom wanted to talk about this, and here's the issue. For me, as a layperson, with a lot of cop friends, let's say, it's unclear to me who's in charge. And this segment, literally, the lower third, Sylvester put up, who's in charge? Question mark. I don't know who's in charge. I don't know when ICE, the feds, come into a community. It could be Jersey City, could be Roxbury, could be Newark, could be Edison, could be anywhere, or anywhere around the country. I don't know when ICE comes in, who's in charge. I know that there's something in New Jersey that the previous Attorney General, Matt Platkin, put into place. It is called the Immigrant Trust Directive, which strictly defines how local police could help or not help the feds enforce immigration law. You know what's so interesting about that? My understanding is that it says that you're not supposed to help facilitate what ICE does. But that doesn't say who's in charge, because what happens, gentlemen, Elvin and Frank, you're in, right? So here's the thing. What happens if ICE is doing something, if an ICE agent with a mask, which in and of itself is an interesting issue, you don't know who they are, they're wearing the mask. The other cops are not. Confusing out of the box for me as a citizen. If ICE is doing something, Elvin, that a local cop, a county cop, a state police officer believes to be wrong, who's in charge? Who is the quarterback? Who calls that play? Can those local enforcement people, cops, step in and go, time out? You can't push that person down on the ground because they are videotaping. Who's in charge? And is it confusing to you as a layperson, Elvin?
I think the fact of the matter is, unfortunately, ICE is in charge. And the only reason why I say that is because they're federal. That is the only reason why I say that. Now, I've always lived by, I think if you see someone doing something wrong, you should say something. So state, local, city, they should, if they see it, they should say something. They should interfere. They should stop it. But I think the problem is a lot of them agree with what ICE is doing, so they don't do anything. And that there is the problem. Now, how do you fix this problem? I don't know, because you can't have police officers fighting ICE, ICE fighting police officers. So I think we're living in a time where everyone's afraid to do something because no one, don't want to be shot. No one wants to be killed. And who's to say ICE won't pull a gun on another police officer?
But doesn't that, Frank, but doesn't that make it clear that the fact that, listen, Derek Chauvin had his knee on the neck, you know how this goes, and there are five cops standing around who did nothing while it was happening, and a man was killed in, on camera. Question, if cops on another level see a cop doing something they think is wrong, listen, I respect the cops, impossible job. But Frank, are we saying from a leadership perspective, if you see another cop because they're feds doing something you think is violating someone's civil rights or violent with them unnecessarily, you just hang back because they're the feds? Is that how it works?
It seems that the municipalities are trying their best to support what's going on as far as the job goes. Now, morally, whether they believe what's going on is correct, that's hard to tell.
How about protecting citizens?
Well, protecting citizens is what they vowed to do. But at this time, I think they're conflicted just as much because their leadership is telling them, stand back, let ICE do what they've come to do. I don't think that all officers that are in the municipal officers are in agreement with that. But I don't know. I think their hands are tied. Like
Tied by their
leadership in their municipality. But, tied by the government that's sending ICE into these municipalities. It's a real thin line. It's a very thin line. These guys have to walk the line of doing their job and feeding their families, as well as listening to their leadership, who's saying, we've got to just sit back because we're going to get chastised by the feds.
They really don't want that. I'm Frank and Elvin, I hear you guys. Let me just say this, and I know we have to say goodbye, Elvin, because there's only one quarterback and it's Elvin here, but I'll say this. With that confusion and that chaos and the standing back, if you see something happening that you believe is wrong and violating a citizen's, an American citizen's civil right to protest or whatever, and you think your job is to hang back because the feds are the feds, I'm going to say from a leadership perspective, from a human perspective, that's scary stuff. Leave it at that. People can decide for themselves. For Frank, Elvin, myself, our entire team, we thank you for watching Lessons in Leadership. Just some thoughts. We'll see you next time. This edition of Lessons in Leadership is made possible by the Vecino Leadership Institute at Seton Hall University, Prager Metis, Valley Bank, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 825, NJ Transit, the Northport Center, O'Toole Scrivo, Gingoli Construction, New Jersey Sharing Network, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, The Helix, Fedway Associates, Inc., the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, Choose New Jersey, and Seton Hall University, inspiring great minds to greater purpose since 1856.
This is Mary Gamba. If you want more leadership tips and tools, log on to stand-deliver.com. That's stand-deliver.com.
Promotional support for this edition of Lessons in Leadership with me, Steve Adubato, and my colleague, Mary Gamba, has been provided by NJ.com, NJBIA, and New Jersey Business Magazine. CIANJ and Commerce Magazine, and the Meadowlands Chamber and Meadowlands Media.